freedom ring. Let freedom ring. Let freedom ring. Let freedom ring.
This is Under the Tree, a seminar on freedom with Bill Ayers.
Welcome back to Under the Tree. I'm Paula Shaw, and I'm here with Roxana Espaz, Bill Ayers, Lidai Lee, and Bernadine Dorn, gathered in the spirit and the memory of Malik Alim for our seminar on freedom.
That was the singer, songwriter, and freedom fighter Tom Morello with Let Freedom Ring, our podcast's hopeful theme song. Tom's generosity is an inspiration. He shows up whenever people are coming together under the banner of freedom in search of peace and justice.
Here's Johnny Cash. Listen up and read between the lines.
I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling all down the San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
It's great to be here with Eric King and Josh Davidson. I'm so happy to have you guys join us. Eric is home since December. Got out of a, 9 or 10 year bid.
Yes, sir.
And Josh and Eric are editors of a wonderful calendar called Certain Days 2024 about political prisoners. It's the Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar. And both are deeply involved in editing a book called Rattling the Cages, Oral Histories of North American Political Prisoners. So they're both deep abolitionists. I know at least one of them is an anarchist. We'll get into that later. We'll get into the fine points later. I couldn't be happier to have you guys join me. I have such admiration for each of you and for the community you've built and for the work you do. Welcome.
Thank you. Privilege to be
here. Thank you so much for having us, Bill.
So let's begin with the book. Rattling the Cages is published by AK Press, and it's been out only a short time, couple months, few months. And I read it when it was in galleys. I found it incredibly illuminating, enlightening, challenging. And I thought you guys might want to tell us a bit, tell our listeners a bit about what led you to write the book, put the book together. It's an oral history, and I think you guys know that I teach oral history at the University of Chicago, and I'm using it in my teaching because I think it's so compelling.
Here we go. Stories,
I'm sorry?
I said, here we go.
You got to have an audience. I really am a huge believer in oral history, the poetry of the street, and I think you guys have captured something super, super important. But talk a bit about the evolution of that book, how it got started, how you know each other, and what's up with that.
So Josh and I met because he had started writing me while I was held in the SHU at Leavenworth. And we became really close friends. Our friendship blossomed off of having a love for elder prisoners, like a love and respect for them. So we started talking about Sundiata and Kawazi and people like that. And our friendship blossomed from that. And over the years, we developed a relationship based off like camaraderie, but also like book reading. And we read an Irish history book, or not Irish history book, but a book about the Troubles, called Say Nothing. And yeah. And so that book really touched me because it dug deep into the trauma of the warriors, the trauma of the fighters, not just the shoot 'em up stuff, but like how it affected them afterwards, how the prison affected them, how that happened, and the emotional toll it took. And it got me thinking about my elders in this movement, in the radical movement, and how often when we hear their voices, what we're hearing is their views on the movement. We're not hearing about their lives, their experiences, like their hurts, their victories, their friendships, their loves. And I thought those stories were needed. They were desperately needed. And so I brought this idea to Josh, and it wasn't going to be a book at first. It was going to be just, I think, a zine basically, or an idea. And then my wife helped spitball ideas, and then Josh, being the just intellectual behemoth that he is, took my minuscule idea, my atom of an idea, and turned it into a mansion. And from there, just snowballed into this beautiful history of political prisoners told with their own words, not being pushed in a direction or having to do revolutionary talk, just saying what's in their hearts in their own voices. And I thought that was really powerful. And I think the book turned out really, really great. Josh,
how about you?
Yeah, thank you. And Eric covered so much of it. We started this book around the time that COVID hit. So, you know, like 4 or 5 years ago now. And it just came out, shockingly, December 5th. So a week before Eric got out of prison. So the timing on that couldn't have been better. But it was a long process. We interviewed about 40 different people who either did time or were still doing time for political reasons in and across North America. And that was people that were imprisoned in the early 70s, some of whom are still imprisoned. And then also people who went to prison within the last 5 or 10 years. So there's a wide range of not only, diverse people from different movements over different generations, but also just different actions and reasons why those people are imprisoned. And I think it's really, a beautiful homage to them, but also just a kind of a great lesson for younger activists today who want to learn from previous movements and they want to learn firsthand from those who have suffered the most.
Yeah, I found the range of folks you got to be somewhat breathtaking. And maybe you tell listeners some of what that range was. I mean, it wasn't all the obvious suspects. It went further than that. And talk a bit about that.
Sure. Yeah. And like Eric said, it started off with just a few names. And most of those were Black liberation people who had been serving decades in prison, namely Sundiata Okoli, Sekou Odinga, who just passed away, Jojo Bowen, Ed Poindexter, and there's so many more, Matula Shakur, who passed away. And there's really probably about a dozen who in the last 5 years or so, 5 or 10 years, have died. And those were people that Kathy Boudin as well. And some, Bo Brown, there's so many of them who have died in the last 10 years. Just amazing radicals and people that we didn't want those stories to not be told. There's a wide range of people. There's nonviolent Catholic activists who did time, including Liz McAllister, who her husband, Philip Berrigan, the two of them were just an amazing powerhouse of radical leftist Catholics and starting in the 60s, but going until still today, Liz is still active. So radical leftists, there's also Black Liberation Army militants and former Black Panthers, former members of the white left and the anti-imperialist left, former members of the Weather Underground, and their supporters.
Let me interrupt you there. What makes them former members? I myself never resigned.
That's a good question. And I personally think that you should maybe have some of those former members on to discuss that.
I still have my Students for a Democratic Society membership card. Anything I've ever belonged to, I'm dragging with me, man.
You know, actually, it's shocking you bring that up. I work at the Zen Education Project, and we had a meeting this morning, and my boss, Bill Bigelow, was teaching a lesson about Palestine in a classroom, and the student had a People's History of the U.S. on their desk, and Bill said, "Where do you hear of this book? Why are you reading this?" And she said, "Oh, I'm actually a member of SDS, and this is in the recommended reading list."
Damn!
Blast from the past.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that's so striking about your work, both of you, is that you started by talking about the elders, you know, Eric, and partly what's great about it is you're having this intergenerational conversation, and the lessons shouldn't die. I mean, one of the great problems of being in the new left, which was what we called ourselves in the 60s, is you don't want to cut off the, I mean, you want to get the new energy and leave behind the stuff that's slowing us down. But at the same time, you don't want to miss the lessons. And I think your book is filled with lessons that are relevant to today's activists and organizers.
So that was really crucial to me, because I found that by reading other political prisoner books that I was growing so much. I was learning not only how to be a prisoner, but like how to be a radical person inside prison, and how to be just how to grow, how not to let prison stagnate you, how not to become stale in your beliefs or in your actions. And I grew so much by hearing from these people that have already experienced it, people that have came before me and could pass down that wisdom and that knowledge if my heart and brain was open to it. And so when Tom Manning passed away, it really hit me, because like I thought about all the stories and all the lessons he had to teach that went with him. And we didn't want to pass up those opportunities to speak to people that had so much to give us. And that's where Josh did such a great job. Especially this is true.
Hey, there it is.
Yeah. We still represent.
Yes, for those of you who are only listening, there's a, he's got a t-shirt with a rainbow and lightning streak on it, even though that's impossible in terms of, you know, the weather, but nonetheless, it's a beautiful symbol. Thank you for that. So, you know, your piece, all the pieces really have a kind of a rhythm that you all set up, right? Like how did you feel first coming into prison? What do you anticipate? What didn't you anticipate? And then ending with, you know, what's the future? But a lot about learning inside. And you had said, Eric, when you started, that you and Josh met when you were in the Shoe at Leavenworth. Tell folks what the Shoe at Leavenworth is.
So the Shoe at Leavenworth is the special housing unit, and that's the hole. And the one at Leavenworth, if you're in the hard cells, you're actually underground. I could see the dirt from my window. It was crazy. And so I was being held there after defending myself from an assault by a lieutenant at a different prison. So they had driven me there after a torturous session at USP Florence. And I was in a cell by myself, just a concrete bed, two doors. And that's when Josh came into my life as like a bright burst of light, lifted me out of that dungeon.
That's beautiful. You know, I think your book in many ways is a bright burst of light. I think your story is very important, how you got into prison, how you survived in prison, and what it means to come home and try to continue the work. You both are hardcore abolitionists. Can you talk a bit about abolition and explain to folks the politics of abolition more than unlocking the doors, which I'm happy with, but I think there's a deeper politics to what abolition means. Maybe chop that up a bit.
Josh.
Sure. Great question. Yeah, you know, there's a lot that goes into considering yourself an abolitionist, and it's not just about tearing down prisons, you know, immediately, although that would be a beautiful thing, but it's about creating a society where that's possible, you know, where you have people coming home that are able to not only survive, but thrive. And, you know, there's a great piece of art in the 2024 Certain Days calendar, of which I'm a member, that I think it's 2024, maybe it's 2023, that says turn every prison into a library. And, you know, I think that that's my idea of abolition. It's creating these, taking these places of oppression and creating something where people can learn and grow and hopefully, you know, just make a better world. Eric, what do you think?
So from an anarchist perspective, like, my view of abolition is creating a society to where prisons can't exist, where there aren't structures around that can imprison people, that have capital to protect, that have to have a lower class to oppress. So when we get rid of that society, when we get rid of those forms of government, then we won't need prisons because every person will be taken care of. We'll be able to take care of each other. And so that's my goal. That's what abolition means to me. Tear down the walls of society that need prisons, that build up prisons.
You know, I love the concept of abolition as you guys are pushing it out. I always go back to Ruthie Gilmore saying abolition is world building work. It's not erasure. It's building a world in which prisons, police, the kind of schools we have and so on are not necessary, including the patriarchal family is not. So I have a book coming out in the fall with Beacon Press. I have another book coming out. This one's called When Freedom is the Question, Abolition is the Answer. And I hope that, Eric, you'll let me come to Denver and do a reading. And I hope, Josh, you'll let me come to Eugene and do a reading. Because it really tries to get into that question of when you talk about freedom, what is it you're talking about? You're talking about abolishing all the structures and strictures that have us caged, whether it's mentally or physically. And you're trying to build something new. And just as Eric says, it means that we have a society where people care for one another, where mutual aid is the name of the game, where punishment is not the default position, and so on. And that's the world I think those of us in this room right now really feel is essential for our ability to breathe free and love freely and so on.
Well said.
Yeah, well said. And I can't wait to read that book. And come on out. We'll have an event.
Love it. And I'll hang out with Bill Bigelow too, because he's an old friend.
Awesome.
Terrific. Yeah. Well, so, you know, going back to just for 1 minute to this question of oral history, there's an oral history that just came out called Rikers, which I've also read. And it's, I really think that what makes your book stand out, and Rikers is an oral history with guards, advocates, a lot of really good people in there, folks who've been put in the cages and so on. But I think that what really makes your book distinct is that you come at it with a point of view that's very explicit. You have a point of view, and it's an abolitionist point of view. It's a free them all point of view. It's a political point of view. Maybe you talk a little bit about that and how that shaped your work.
So there was a point of view, and that point of view was that prisoners are people, and that political prisoners have a unique perspective, both with their experiences inside and their experiences outside that landed them in prison. And that not only are they political prisoners, but they are humans. And I wanted to dive into that. I wanted to dive into what it is like inside when you live your ethics, when you put your values and your ethics into action and you pay the price for that. And so I wanted people to be able to explain what it means to be a prisoner of conscience, a prisoner of action, and how they express that within the walls, how they express who they are and what they believe in while still surviving in prison and still growing in prison. And Josh did a really great job with that. I wrote out a bunch of questions that I would like answered. Like, what would I like to ask Sundiata Okoli that would help me understand him as a person, but also help me grow as a person myself? And Josh took those questions, modified them, put them in the perfect way, and he was able to get people to really open up and be vulnerable and like share their experiences.
Yeah, I found that absolutely the way you're describing it, Eric, is very helpful to me because and Josh's role in it and so on, because I thought it was absolutely revealing. These folks weren't doing boilerplate. They weren't doing Q&A. They were going
exactly. Yeah, exactly. Josh, you can dig into that because you carried out all the interviews like a beast. But That was the whole point. We didn't want to do the same standard. We're here to tear down or here to do this or that. We want to know who these people really were and like what was inside their hearts. So Josh, go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, for us, it wasn't really a matter of like trying to include our politics. That just kind of, it's going to be included. It's who we are. And there is an objective, you know, we want a world without political prisoners and without prisons. So this book is an attempt to open people's eyes to that, to turn on the light and let people see what's really going on in there. And I think that people do a great job of that, that there's a wide range of people not only showing the depths of oppression and repression that go on there, but also just the levels of resistance and love and courage that are also there.
No, you guys have done a great job. And for me, I mean, what I admire the most is exactly what you're saying, that it's the humanization of people who've been dehumanized. It's the illumination of people who've been erased. And I just found it so moving to see the three-dimensionality of everybody that you touched, including, of course, y'all. But I think this is something that should be all of our project as we're moving forward. Our friend Ronaldo Hudson, who got out after 38 years, 11 on death row in Illinois. Ronaldo says our project should be demonstrification. And I like that because, you know, death row in Illinois was, that's where the monsters are, the worst of the worst. And we got rid of death row. Now the guys who are doing death by incarceration, you know, life without possibility, they're the monsters. They're the worst of the worst. And it's hard to overcome that. So Rachel DeWaskin and I teach in Illinois State Prison, and we took our students' work and made this magazine out of their work, Humans of Life Row. And that's exactly what you're saying, Eric, is that we're taking that idea of Humans of New York, and we're saying instead of calling it death row, we're calling it life row. We're living, we're human beings, and we have every right to be treated as human beings with human rights, right? So I think that you guys and we're in absolute harmony with one another.
I'd like to just say that, like, I just got out of ADX, the Federal Supermax, and that's the whole pitch that they do there, is like, this is the worst of the worst, the most violent, the most despicable people. And every person I met in there was a human. There was someone that loved and had fears and insecurities and joys and hopes. And to just diminish these people and like make their life mean nothing except for your title of them, it was sickening. It was sickening to see these people who will never get out of prison be basically shit on. Yeah. And the media plays into it, like, you know. And so I like to illuminate those people as well. And hopefully one day we can tear down those Supermax walls and tear down all these walls.
I think that's so important. I mean, you know, we don't have to go to the point of romanticizing people and saying they're perfect. They're not perfect. But like Ronaldo often says, everyone I met on death row, I like the second chance program, but everyone I met on death row, including me, never had a first chance. In other words, I was homeless, I was illiterate, and so on. So second chance, oh, God bless it. But when we talk about the kind of world we need to build where prisons are not necessary or not the default position, people have to have a first chance. The other thing that Ronaldo says, and I felt this reading your book, he says, I got arrested as a teenager and nobody ever said to me, what do you need? And then for the next 38 years, nobody said, what do you need? And when they let me out, they gave me a parole officer, not a social worker, not a therapist. Nobody said, what do you need? And that's something that I think your book implies again and again. What do we need? And part of what we need is to be recognized as full human beings, flawed, messed up, did some messed up things perhaps, but we are fully human and we deserve the respect and the awe that every human being deserves.
It's not asking much.
No, I think it's a minimum program, but I think it's an uphill fight nonetheless, you know, to say, these are three-dimensional humans. And that's why publishing this kind of work or your kind of work is so important, because it rips the mask off the myth of monsters. And I think it shows us people who are real and complex and three-dimensional, and they have needs and they have hopes and like every other human being you ever met. Let me ask you but one more point I'm going to make on this question of what is abolition. When Kathy was in prison, and I was visiting her one day, and we were talking about abolition, and she leaned into me, and she was half joking and said, "Listen, man, you don't want some of these people on the street." And we laughed. And we joked about it because she was, of course, kidding. But what she meant was, we don't have a world that would welcome us all and that would be able to uplift us all. But that's the world we need to build. And that's something that, of course, Kathy got out after 22 years in and spent the next 20 years building just that kind of project and this, just that kind of movement. So, you know, respect.
Absolutely.
I often try to live by Kathy's words. She understood it. She got it. And like, I get what she's saying too, because you meet people in prison and inside they might come across as monsters, like how they're portrayed or how they portray themselves. But that's a healing mechanism. That's a survival mechanism. And if you get to that point, like, most likely society crafted you into that. Someone beat you and built you and compressed you into this mode to where you have to be this way to survive. And I reject the government's notion that those people don't deserve love and that they don't deserve to be seen and heard and given a chance to grow, given a chance to achieve. If we lived in a better society, like, we wouldn't have people like that, I feel.
I think you're right. And I think that's a really important point. I want to go for a minute to the calendar. You all have also edited and put out a calendar called Certain Days, the 2024 Freedom for Political Prisoners calendar. How can folks get the calendar, first of all?
Excellent question. They can go to certaindays.org or burningbooks.com or any radical bookstore. Hopefully go, you know, if you have a local bookstore, go ask them to carry it. But
they do carry it.
Okay, good, good. And the calendar, as Bill knows, it's been around for 25 years now, and it was started by three former political prisoners, David Gilbert, Herman Bell, and Seth Hayes, who are all now luckily out.
Well, RIP, yep. Seth Hayes. I would like to say, Bill, like, I don't have any role in the calendar.
I think you did. Well, you've got an essay in it.
Yeah, I'm a contributor to it. And I have to say, like, that calendar was a blessing inside because it's filled with history. It's filled with prisoner voices. And like, everyone I've given it to inside loves it. And I'm proud to write for it whenever I get the opportunity, but that's Josh and Sarah and the rest of that crew. That's all their hard work.
Okay. I appreciate that. But I happen to love your essay in the calendar.
Okay.
I think it's called, I Learned from David Gilbert or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
David taught us a lot of lessons.
David taught me. Yeah. You know, it's funny, when Miriam Kaba left Chicago, the present that the movement gave her, the, you know, hundreds of us, is each of us made a short clip for a film, and each of us stood up and said, "Miriam taught me," and then we filled in the blank. And so she's got a little film of you know, dozens and dozens of people saying, "Miriam taught me." But I felt that same vibe from your piece in the calendar, you know, David taught me, and we learn from each other, and acknowledging our mentors is, I think, important. And we learn from each other. It's mutual.
Yeah. So I was reading David's books before I got in. And then when I was inside, people kept shooting me different ones and different articles. And what struck me was his level of humility. Like, and his level of self accountability. Like, here's the mistakes I made. Here's how we can grow from them. And then also learning about how he didn't abandon Kwasi. Like, Kwasi had HIV or AIDS, and in prison that is so stigmatized. And David didn't buy into it. And instead he leaned into that friendship. And when Kwasi passed away, like, he kept teaching to try to help other people. He refused to let that death be in vain. And that just touched me so powerfully reading about that history.
No,
I need to honor that guy.
No, it's a remarkable story, because at a point when homophobia, especially where David was living, you know, all that stuff was so powerful. And instead of running away from it, he dived right into it, and he built an AIDS education program that was a model for prisons all over the country, really. That was a beautiful thing.
I got to say, like, and that inspired me and gave me the courage when I was in prison. Like, I didn't abandon the gay prisoners. And right. sometimes there was this, but like, if David can do it for 40 years, I need to stand with my people as well. And like, he taught us how to be brave.
I love that, Eric. And the other thing you said that I think is really important for folks to hear is you talked about accountability. I don't know anyone, my students at Stateville have been more accountable for their behavior than any of us on the outside have ever been. In other words, they've spent more time sitting with it. They've spent more time trying to understand it. And so you point to David as an example of that. He's done it publicly. But the guys I work with, they are so accountable for whatever problems they've caused in the community, and so much better than any professor I know, you know, whose misdeeds are just swept away. You know, I mean, I think accountability matters, but I think that sometimes it gets used to say, well, you did a bad deed. You got to be accountable the rest of your life in this completely humiliating and fucked up way. And I think that's something that, that you're pointing to that I think is hugely important.
No, well said. Well said.
One other thing that I want to get to with your calendar here. It's got essays, it's got art, it's got important dates. Everyone should have it on the wall somewhere in their apartment or house. But you make a distinction, which I want you to talk about a little bit, because when you say political prisoner, what does that mean? And you distinguish that from prisoner of war, and you distinguish that from politicized prisoners. So I think I'd like to have you tell folks a little bit what those distinctions mean, because sometimes when people think political prisoner, they think this old Soviet Union or they think Iran or something. But you guys have a very clear sense of who's a political prisoner, who's a prisoner of war, who's a politicized prisoner. I mean, was Malcolm X a political prisoner? He didn't go in for a political crime, but on the other hand, he became very political in the joint. So maybe you'd talk a bit, Josh, about that distinction.
Sure. And great question. And that, you know, there's no clear cut definition necessarily. People argue sometimes violently about what one is or the other. But generally speaking, a political prisoner is someone who is incarcerated for an action or sometimes even a belief or an affiliation with an organization that is attempting to change the government. Usually in our sense, and in the sense that people on the left are using it, we are speaking of people who are trying to make a better world. People who, whether violently or nonviolently, are taking a stand to make something better than it is and have been captured and are in prison for those political reasons. A politicized prisoner would be someone like Malcolm X, who went to prison in what would be called a social crime. He went to prison. He became politicized in prison, and he, you know, his consciousness expanded. His understanding of the role of prison in society expanded and grew. So he would be considered a politicized prisoner. And people who are not in prison for political reasons or for that those reasons would be considered social prisoners. But there's also an understanding that all prisoners are political, that prisons by their very nature are political systems that are meant to oppress certain people, and that therefore anyone, you know, ensnared within those confines is there for a political reason. So, you know, it's definitions that are kind of slippery, but in general, you know, it's a matter of what leads someone to prison, I think.
You know, I wouldn't say slippery so much as dynamic and ever-changing, you know?
Yes, that's a much...
You're not trying to slip something over me. You're trying to be open to the fact that language is always changing and that language is never standing still. And these categories aren't categorical, fixed in stone. They're a moving target. But I particularly appreciate your saying that on some level, because we live in a racial capitalist society, an imperialist society, a war-making society, people go to prison because they're caught up in something. And so you look at Chicago and you look at the neighborhoods that have been devastated by mass incarceration. And that's not an accident. You know, there are crimes all over the place, but these folks are targeted. And you know, and the community is targeted. So everyone in there is assumed to be something of a criminal, or every man between 18 and 28, you know. I mean, so in that sense, I think your definitions or your tentative meanings are very, very important. I got a couple other quick questions. One, we're going to quibble about language a little bit. I like saying dynamic, not slippery. I don't like the word allies. I don't like the word white allies or male allies.
Interesting.
I don't like that word, and I'll tell you why. It has a little bit of the feel of condescension to me. A little
patronizing,
bit
patronizing, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit of feel like I'm helping you. You know, I want to get rid of male supremacy because my life will be better. Women's lives will be better too, but I'll be freed when women are freed. I'll be freed as a white person when black folks are freed. What will I be freed from? I'll be freed from the precarious, you know, nature of trying to hold on to that pathetic privilege that white supremacy grants, right? So since I'll be freed, I'm fighting for my freedom. I'm also fighting for collective freedom. But the reason I don't like ally is it has a little bit of the Lady Bountiful built into it. I want to call people comrades. You're my comrade. You know, we're in it together, arm in arm, heart to heart, onto the next barricade. What do you think?
Yeah. I am also not a fan of the term ally at all. I like comrade or co-conspirator. I think that we're all, you know, conspiring to create something better. So I think that's an apt term as well.
And I gotta be honest, I've used the term ally in the past, and I always feel a little dirty when I've just said it before. I'm not gonna lie.
I've used it too. But I think, like everything else, language is dynamic. Let's move forward. I like co-conspirator. Josh just offered co-conspirator, comrade. And then I think of what the Panthers used to call us. They used to call us mother country radicals. And I like that term too. If you think of it as an imperial system, we're in the mother country. and we're fighting the same monster, different tactics, different moments, different so on. But I think that's worth pointing to. You also said, Eric, or I've heard you say, that you're an anarchist. And give me a hint about, give folks a little thought about what it means to be an anarchist today in America.
So just speaking for myself, of course, I believe that being an anarchist means that you believe that humans have the capabilities to live, grow, and love without hierarchical structures, that we do not need leaders or bosses or masters or landlords or husbands or fathers or any hierarchical structure that can demean or put someone in a place. That we're capable of living without these things, that we can work as a community, as a group of people together to achieve our goals and our needs, that there's enough to go around and we don't need bosses to dictate how to put it out. For me, that means no cops. For me, that means no bosses. For me, that means this guy over here telling me that I can't wear this hat or that shirt. Like, I don't have time for that. We don't have time for putting people in their place, like that we can grow together, we can learn together, we can love together, and we can move forward as a society without domination. That's what it means to me.
Man, you got to go on the road, man. That's the best simple explanation. Just beautiful.
That's flattering. Thank you.
Beautifully said. And, you know, I have a book in the other room called No Gods, No Masters.
Love it.
Yeah, and that's the whole point, just what you said. You know, we don't need bosses. We don't need – so I was in Greece, and I, through mutual friends, I spent a day with the anarchist Manolis Glesos, who died recently at the age of 94. But Manolis was arrested for taking the Nazi flag off the Acropolis when the Germans were occupying Greece. And he spent his whole life as an anarchist, and he even was the mayor of a small island. And he
only in Greece.
And he ran it, with the principles of the old Greek anarchy. I mean, he decisions were made in the forum. There was no specialist. If you wanted to be the commissioner of water, just put your name in a hat. Better read than expert. Anyway, it was a beautiful thing. But when I was leaving, you brought him to mind, because when I was leaving after spending a day with Manolis, he said to me, you know, Bill, I think you have the same problem in the U.S. that we have here in Greece. And that is, you don't have the confidence as a people to believe that you could exist without police chiefs or mayors or senators or bosses. If you could get that confidence that we can take care of ourselves in face-to-face, you know, meetings and so on, then we would move humanity forward. And I thought that was really great. I came back to the U.S. and it happened, there was a mayoral election going on and the progressives were trying to settle on a candidate. Every meeting I went to, I said, why do we need a mayor? And after a while, he said, shut the fuck up, Bill. I mean, we're going to have a mayor, motherfucker, you know, stop, don't be so stupid. But honestly, I was channeling monoliths and I was presaging Eric. So I think you make a very good point, man. Very good point. I've always disliked labels as a teacher. I've never gone for labels, BD, EMH, blah, blah, blah. And so I don't easily settle on a label. So I often say when it comes to government and hierarchy, I'm an anarchist. When it comes to the economy, I'm more of a socialist. When it comes to, you know, free speech, I'm kind of a fundamentalist. You know, I mean, I could go through the whole, when it comes to religion, I'm an atheist. You know, I could go through the whole thing. But no single label, just like these other definitions, no single label really fits for me. You know, I have to keep, I'm large. I contain contradictions, just like other people. Anyway, okay. So that's a really helpful. That's helpful to me, Eric. I appreciate your.
Just so you know, I also spent time in Greece. I was there for the austerity protests in either 08 or 09. I got to spend a lot of time with those dudes.
I think I was there right around then.
I saw when the folks jumped the fence and spray painted the pink house. Their version of the White House?
I think we overlapped because I was invited there to give a talk at an anarchist convention. And then when they picked me up at the airport, I said, hey, wait a minute, how can you guys call yourselves anarchists if you're having a convention? And they laughed and said, you're just part of our front group. You don't worry about it. Yeah. And I told them when I was coming over, all I need was a place to stay, which I stayed in one of their squats. And you know, maybe you guys
can
help.
You stayed in a squat?
Yeah. Hell yes.
Good for you.
And ate rice and beans, man. That's the only way to go. I had a great time there. A really great time.
Big Bill, keeping it real.
We got to meet up, Eric, for sure.
Yeah, listen, you're cool as shit.
I got one more thing I need to ask you guys.
All right.
Which is, for me, the great question that I'm struggling with day in and day out is that we have in Illinois, I think we have nationally, a tremendous number of projects, people, campaigns, organizations that are all leaning toward abolition of prisons. I think that we have a great network. We were at an opening the other night of an art space that the Prison and Neighborhood Arts and Education Project just opened. There must have been 300 people there. And, you know, so I kept thinking, we're so big on some level, we're so complex, we're so multi-layered. What does it take? What are the steps we need to take to go from organizations, campaigns, individuals to a social movement that becomes irresistible? What are things we should be doing? Are we doing the right things? Are there things folks who are listening to this or me that we should be doing to make this a movement, a social movement that's irresistible?
So, Josh, can I go first if that's okay? I first want to say, like, I feel as if our movement is so sectarian, and it's always been, I guess, to where there's 1,000 groups and each one thinks only they have the answer. And then when we move forward, we move out. We're not moving forward together towards a cause. We're moving out towards our own cause. We want to be the ones. But I also think we're too soft on prisons. I think the abolitionist movement relies too much on feel good vibes and too much on trying to make those in power feel bad about their power, as opposed to hitting their pockets, hitting what actually like moves them. Like, if we want to tear down prisons, we got to tear down the things that finance prisons. We got to hit the industries profiting off of prison slave labor. We got to hit these groups that are benefiting from human enslavement. And we don't do that. We focus on things like, let's vote out this person or let's talk about this person. And to me, that doesn't work. I've never seen anything get replaced because those in charge just said, like, okay, like, I feel bad. You're right. Let's change. And we're not going to vote in someone that's going to change it, in my mind, because they still answer to the capitalist power structure. They still have to answer to those that put the money in their pockets. So until we start hitting those that finance prison and those that get rich off of slavery, we're going to have human slavery in America. Like, that's just how it's going to be in my mind.
So let me ask you two questions, and then go to you, Josh. The two quick questions. One is, how do we overcome sectarianism? What are some methods or tactics or strategies we could use to come to some unity around some of our demands? That's number one. And number two is, how do we hit them the finances? How do we hit the pocketbook? So I mean, I agree with skepticism about voting and skepticism that anybody will change their mind because we've made a better moral argument. But it doesn't mean we can't convince masses of people on a moral argument. We can.
And we should.
But they're not going to change. The governor's not going to change because we made a good moral argument. So, yeah, I think I'd be interested to answer those two questions. How do we hit the financial? How do we overcome sectarianism?
So the sectarianism question, I have no idea. It feels like it feels egotistical. It feels as if, I don't know. I read the books from the 60s, the 70s, the 80s. It feels like we just make the same mistakes when it comes to just all making up our own minds and going our own paths. Instead of going as a strong fist, we go as little fingers. So I don't know. As far as hitting him in the pockets, huh?
Go ahead.
As far as hitting him in the pockets, boycott, divest. We can put public pressure on companies. That's who does answer, because they have to answer to stockholders. They have to answer to share prices. So we can hit capital where it hurts by stop spending money on companies that are supporting prison slavery. Stop giving them permission with our wallets. And these companies don't hide it. Like, they don't hide that they're using prison slave labor. So we, as a movement, if we were unified, could put that out. We could shame these companies to death and then make them have to quit supporting these industries.
Well, let me challenge you and myself and Josh and whoever's listening. Let me just challenge it this way, that I think you have a very sharp idea about boycott, divest, you know, and I think that's a good idea. But that's one of the ways we could overcome sectarianism. If we could mobilize, organize around, here's a target we can all agree about. We may disagree about, like, you and I want to get rid of racial capitalism. You and I want to end imperialism. We want to close the Pentagon. Everyone in our coalition might not agree with that. But if we can all agree that caging human beings and slave labor is wrong, and therefore we're going to boycott and divest from these places, I think that could be a unifying call. So you've already encouraged me, Eric.
That's very flattering, Bill. Thank you. Josh, go ahead before I start weeping.
No, I think you two nailed it. You know, I with the passing of Terry Bison recently, I'm rereading Fire on the Mountain. And
great book.
You know, 165 years ago, John Brown, an abolitionist, tried to make a stand and tried to stand up against the social ill. And I think we need that again now, in whatever form that may come in.
Yeah, I think we should look for – the other thing I would say is, I look to the Vietnamese, I look to the abolitionist movement of the 19th century, and I look to other revolutions, and I try to study the way they overcome sectarianism. And I'd say one of the things that the Vietnamese taught us, even though we were, you know, when you point to sectarianism in the 60s and 70s, I saw you pointing right at me, man. And since I took the live virus and survived, I'm pretty much against orthodoxy all the time. But, you know, the reality is that the Vietnamese were very clear on the fact that you have to name the political moment, name the stage that you're in, and what we can unite around. So they named, get the French out, get the Americans out. That was a step where they could bring in all kinds of people who wouldn't be with them when they were fighting for socialism or but they could be with them around this. So the question, I like the way you said, we can actually name targets that we are going to boycott and divest from, and we can actually go after those. So maybe that's a unifying demand, a unifying thing that can overcome sectarianism in the moment, in this political moment, because I think the energy, the anti-prison energy is there, but it doesn't yet have what I would call the energy of a social movement that's irresistible. It's there. There's a moral argument there. There's a political consciousness there even, but it doesn't yet have a focus, a demand. And that's what you're providing, Eric. So got to get out there. Get out there. Let's get out there together, arm in arm, shoulder to shoulder.
Yes.
Right on. Hopefully Eric can be the, you know, the spark with the prairie right. fire.
Well, I'm going to be standing right behind him in my walker. You know, I'm old. So, counting on the youth. Listen, guys, it's been more than a pleasure. It's been an absolute honor to talk with each of you. And I hope that maybe you could we could end by saying, you mentioned, Josh, how they can get a hold of the book and so on. How can folks get a hold of you too if they need to, or is it just through the calendar, through the book?
Well, for me, I'm going to go first, go ahead. Josh. people can get a hold of me on social media, Instagram, support Eric King. I'm working at the Bread and Roses Legal Center. You can hit me up there. And I'm there to talk. I'm available. I want to plan things. I want to help. I want to be a part of this struggle, and I want ideas and I want conversations. So any of those places, Rattling the Cages, book on social media, support Eric King, Bread and Roses Legal Center. I'm open for conversation.
I love it, man. Thank you so much. How about you, Josh?
Yeah, same here. You can reach me on social media. You can reach me through the calendar, through the Zen Education Project. The book also has a website. I think it's rattlingthecagesbook.com. That's listed at the back of the website, or the back of the book, I'm sorry. But yeah, we're available for book events, for online talks, for whatever will help, you know, expand the conversation of abolition and help bring these people home where they belong.
Phil, thank you so much.
As I say, I really appreciate you guys. Deep, deep appreciation. And let's stay in the struggle together, arm in arm, as I said. And together, you know, we can win. I mean, we can win, and we have to believe it. And I believe it.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
We're up all night dreaming. We aren't alive as long as there's a prison guard still breathing. So we're up all night scheming. We don't get tired, we get even. I can't sleep anyway.
And rebuild this broken world. Let's try to stay all the way human.
Thanks to Damon Williams and Daniel Kisslinger at the generative and provocative podcast Ergo, co-conspirators Roxana Espos and Pallas Shaw.
Go forward, keep rising, and live your life as if it were an abolitionist's dream.
With joy in my heart and freedom on my mind, until next time.